BBC News with Sue Montgomery. Survivors from a migrant boat that broke down and drifted at sea for several days trying to reach Europe say at least 60 people who were on the vessel died. They say the engine cut out when they were trying to cross from Libya, leaving them drifting without food or water. 25 others were rescued by humanitarian group SOS Méditerranée. Laurence Bondar is a spokeswoman for the organisation.
The survivors were suffering from hypothermia, almost all extremely dehydrated, having drunk only little seawater to survive, in great psychological distress also after having seen dozens of people, including family members, die in the makeshift boat.
The pioneering Starship rocket developed by Elon Musk's firm SpaceX has made its longest and most ambitious test flight so far. Contact with Starship was broken as it began its re-entry into Earth's atmosphere. SpaceX confirmed the craft was lost. Here's our science correspondent, Jonathan Amos.
Entrepreneur Elon Musk was looking for significant progress from his SpaceX team, and he got it. The huge Starship rocket made a clean getaway from its launch mount on the Texas coast and stepped perfectly through all the expected milestones of the ascent. Video cameras on the vehicle's upper segment, or ship, sent back spectacular views of the Earth from more than 100 miles up. It appears the ship didn't survive the fiery heat of re-entry to make a splashdown in the Indian Ocean, but engineers will be more than satisfied that their development of the world's most powerful rocket is on track.
A representative of the community in Nigeria, where nearly 300 schoolchildren were kidnapped last week, says it will be impossible for a ransom to be raised. He said the families were too poor. On Wednesday, the gunmen phoned to demand hundreds of thousands of dollars. More from our Africa regional editor, Will Ross.
Jibril Gwadabe from Kariga in Kaduna State says many of the families can't even afford three meals a day, so raising the ransom of hundreds of thousands of dollars is out of the question. He said the students, aged between 7 and 12, were forced to walk huge distances through the bush and were extremely weak without food and water. Mr. Gwadabe said the gunman had told him during the phone call about the ransom that they'd seized the children because military aircraft had been killing them and their cattle. The community leader said the parents of the missing children were in a desperate state.
The leader of a sect in Zimbabwe has been charged in court with child abuse after police said they had rescued more than 250 children living on his farm. Police said the children were being prevented from going to school and were forced to work as cheap labour. You're listening to the World News from the BBC. The lower house of parliament in Spain has approved a controversial amnesty law for separatists in Catalonia, who held an independence referendum 7 years ago in defiance of the national government. The vote was narrowly in favour. The law will now go to the Spanish Senate, which can delay its approval but not block it. The US Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer has said Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu no longer meets the needs of his country and Israelis should hold an election. Mr. Schumer, a Democrat and America's most senior Jewish politician, said Israel was pursuing dangerous and inflammatory policies.
We should not be forced into a position of unequivocally supporting the actions of an Israeli government that include bigots who reject the idea of a Palestinian state. 5 months into this conflict, it is clear that Israelis need to take stock of the situation and ask, must we change course? At this critical juncture, I believe a new election is the only way to allow for a healthy and open decision-making process about the future of Israel.
The senior Republican Senator Mitch McConnell condemned Chuck Schumer's remarks as grotesque and hypocritical. Police in the Philippines have rescued hundreds of people from an online scam centre where workers were forced into trying to defraud customers. A police raid discovered more than 400 Chinese nationals and 370 Filipinos. A judge in London has ruled that an Australian computer scientist is not the true inventor of Bitcoin, who goes under the alias Satoshi Nakamoto. Craig Wright has claimed to be Nakamoto since 2016, but cryptocurrency experts have long questioned this. The Crypto Open Patent Alliance, backed by major firms, brought the action. BBC News.
The 2024 Wisconsin Film Festival is coming to Madison Thursday, April 4th through Thursday, April 11th. This year's festival boasts over 140 films of all shapes and sizes, including the best cinema has to offer from all over the world and right here in Wisconsin. We've got experimental, animated, and student films, as well as documentaries, restored classics, films for kids, and more. For the first time in years, we'll be returning to both the Bartell Theater and the Barrymore Theater. Plus, we've expanded on the UW campus into Music Hall, and we are heading east to Flick's Brewhouse at the Easttown Mall. The Wisconsin Film Festival curates, promotes, and exhibits programs that showcase the art of cinema. A complete festival guide is available in the March issue of Isthmus and online, and tickets are available at wifilmfest.org. The 2024 Wisconsin Film Festival is coming to a screen near you, Thursday, April 4th through Thursday, April 11th. Helping keep local arts alive for almost 50 years, this is WORT Madison.
Six above sea level. I grab the mic because I like to take you to another mental level. Low power frequency radio modulation.
And good afternoon. Welcome to this, the Thursday edition of A Public Affair. I'm your host for this hour. My name is Alan Ruff. What has been described as a David versus Goliath contest has been going on for some time in the Lake Superior region of northern Wisconsin. On one side stands the Canada-based pipeline energy multinational Enbridge Corporation. On the other, in the forefront of a growing movement in opposition to the corporate giant, is the Bad River Band of Lake Superior Chippewa. The contest centers on the Enbridge push to renovate and expand its 70-year-old Line 5 that carries carries toxic tar sands oil from west to east across the state and cuts through the Bad River Reservation. The Bad River Band is determined to bring a halt to the Enbridge project. Joining us today to discuss a broad range of concerns regarding the Up North face-off will be environmental activist Aurora Conley of the Bad River Band. Also with us for the first part of the hour will be Mary Mazzio, the award-winning documentary filmmaker and director of the about-to-be-released documentary Bad River, which will be shown in Madison and select cities around the country starting tomorrow. Mary Mazzio, I understand, of course, that you can only be with us for a part of the hour, so I wanted to allow you some time to talk about Bad River. Give our listeners some sense of what it is about and why you and numerous others set out to tell this story of Bad River and its people.
So thank you, Alan, and thank you for having Aurora and I on your show this morning. This originally was going to be a David and Goliath story, right? You've got this small tribal community, the Bad River Band, and they are waging this sort of monumental epic battle to protect Lake Superior. And, you know, at stake, you've got a pipeline that the lower court in this case, the Bad River, had to file suit when Enbridge several easements along about a quarter of the entire pipeline corridor expired 10 years ago. So you have 3 miles of pipeline corridor that the pipeline operator no longer has the right to operate. Combine that with there is a place in the Bad River, which, by the way, flows into Lake Superior. She's changing her course, and she's heading straight for the pipeline. Both the judge in the lower court also found that this could rupture, a catastrophic rupture, even as soon as the next major flood to hit the Bad River Reservation. So you have this small group of people that are protecting a resource, not just for them, but for all of us. And by the way, at great cost to both themselves financially, to the challenges that are happening within the community over this, and they're doing it for all Americans. And I heard two really interesting comments. We were at an event that the Motion Picture Association hosted last night, and a former chairman, Mike Wiggins, said this about the battle. He said, you know, we view our fight as patriotic This is part of our civic duty to the country to protect this resource. It is the freshwater stronghold for America. And current chairman, Bob Blanchard, said, you know, when just last week, I think, Enbridge posted an open letter to the band with an $80 million offer to settle the case, an extraordinary amount of money for a small, historically neglected community, as you can imagine. And Bob Blanchard responded, our water, our treaty rights are not for sale. So this started out as this major David and Goliath story, but it really turned into something quite different once we started interviewing elders who had extraordinary generosity of spirit in terms of sharing their story, sharing their history of not only what happened in this country and, you know, from the founding of America onwards, but also their own personal stories of how they, their parents, their grandparents all fought back in different ways. And so, yes, they wanted to speak to the pipeline issue, but they also wanted to speak to beating back the mining, the open pit mine. That was, that fight was only, you know, 2014, 2015. And then they wanted to go back in time with other acts of resistance. And I'll tell you, Alan, when these stories were unfolding with interviews, the hair on the back of my neck started to rise, because it was like the stories were so filled with pride and never say die, and just this extraordinary spirit of, as Running Horse Livingston said in one email, you know, win, lose, or draw, we are going to fight the good fight, and we will have the bruises to show for that.
Mary Mazzio, the film is not just focused on the present. It places the current struggle, as you've already mentioned, of the Bad River people to a much longer history of white encroachment on the land, a continuation of a struggle that extends, you know, well, certainly back way into the 19th century. Why was it important to bring that longer history, much of it tragic, and not so tragic, there's a struggle, there's a resistance, but why was it important to bring that into the frame of reference for the story today?
Great, great question, Alan. And that is because that's where the elders wanted this project to go. They did not want to just focus on the current battle, but rather the context was, this is a very old story with this, this pipeline challenge is a new chapter of a very old story. And my co-producer, who traces her lineage back to Stockbridge Muncie, she's a writer for Narcos and West Wing, Allison Abner, she said, Americans will not understand this current battle if they do not understand the history of fighting for land, fighting for clean water, fighting for sense of self. And so we had battles, Alan, like whether we should include certain aspects in time. And ultimately, I think Allison's guidance and discipline as a writer for, you know, such storied franchises, and it makes the overall film eminently richer because of it.
You know, we only have you for a few more minutes, so I wanted to give us the information about the film. There's select screenings around the country starting tomorrow. One of them in the Madison area, and there's one in Milwaukee as well. Do you have that information at hand?
Yes, if www.badriverfilm.com /dates/, we are partnering with AMC Theaters. We're opening up in 12 cities across the country, which is highly unusual, as you can imagine, for a documentary to open in multiplexes. And we're very excited. We're hearing that certain locations on opening night are already selling out. We know that it's very popular in Madison, in Minneapolis, in Ashland. We're also opening in Detroit, LA, New York, et cetera. So we're very excited about this. The project itself is narrated by Quanta Chasing Horse, an amazing activist and model. And then, of course, a three-time Academy Award nominee, Edward Norton. And they bring an extraordinary richness to the overall story. If I can say one other thing,
please,
Alan, and that is that this film is an extraordinary counterpoint to Killers of the Flower Moon. Right? Killers of the Flower Moon, you had a historical retrospective through the eyes of cowboys and settlers with murder and mayhem, right, left in its wake. Fast forward 100 years, it's still a story about oil and money, but it's told through the lens of the Bad River people in a way that is, hell no, we have something to say about this. We're going to fight back. And that's what has made this so exciting to work on for the entire team behind Bad River.
Well, look, some parting words about the film or yourself or for our listeners.
Oh, I feel indebted to the Bad River community, especially the elders, for opening up their hearts and sharing their stories with someone who's non-native. And I am a richer person because of it. And, you know, I think when we had the screening last night, you're about to talk to Aurora. There was an eruption in the crowd when Aurora came on screen. She has several mic drops as a younger Bad River member, and her thoughts and journeys about, again, the urgency to protect the resource for all of us. There is an extraordinary selflessness in what the Bad River Band is doing. And I think myself included, if more Americans were more community oriented like that, boy, would we be in a better place.
Well, again, I want to thank you very much. Even just watching the trailer, I was moved. So I want to urge our listeners to get out to see it. Give that website again one more time.
Thank you, Alan. www.badriverfilm.com. We are sharing 50% of our profits back to support the band. And so if your listeners can't make it to the theater, we'd love them to buy tickets early and often.
Well, thank you again, and hope you get an Academy Award.
Yay! Thank you, Alan. Really appreciate the time, and you're just going to be amazed by Aurora Connolly, who is just a rock star.
Well, that's a nice segue, because we have patiently waiting with us as well is Aurora Connolly, who is a member of the Bad River Band. And an activist for many years. We have a mutual friend who's filled me in some on your longer history, even going to Central America and so on. So it's a pleasure to have you back. Aurora Connolly, numerous issues and concerns surround the Enbridge Corporation's renovation and expansion of Line 5. Describe the pipeline project currently already, you know, underway, its purpose, and how it poses a threat on numerous levels.
Thanks, Alan, and thanks for having me on the show again. I greatly appreciate being able to speak. Okay, so Enbridge Line 5 was built in 1953, and it has a number of types of easements, and they're individual easements expired in 2013. And that's when we as a tribe had decided that we weren't going to renew those easements with them. And so to speak, I think that's when you think of conflict, it has to be a perceived type of conflict. And I think that's when the perception from Enbridge became that this is a conflict. For us, it had always been a conflict in terms of the Bureau of Indian Affairs are the ones that actually allowed that easement to come through in 1953.
But for our listeners that might not be acquainted, what do you mean by what's an easement?
An easement is a right-of-way that gives them permission to cross our land. Okay. So originally, those easements were authorized by the Bureau of Indian Affairs, the Great Lakes region, in this area. So the tribe really didn't have much of a say back in 1953 when all this originally had went through. Until we come to 2013, when it is more about tribal sovereignty and exercising our rights. And that's when in 2013 we decided that we weren't going to renew it because of the risks and the back history of Enbridge. Not just with our tribe, but with many different agencies and many different tribes across the nation with their pipelines.
Talk about the band's specific concerns. There are many, of course, but maybe list some of the key ones, and then we can go deeper as we progress here, I hope.
Definitely. I think originally we just wanted to exercise our tribal sovereignty and decide that we didn't want the pipeline to come through our reservation anymore, regardless of the imminent risks, which after the 2016 flood, I don't know if some of your listeners remember this, but it was pretty catastrophic up here in the northern region of our area. And when I say northern, I say Lake Superior type northern. I know some folks in Madison think of up north as far as Rhinelander, but we're way up here in the small region. We're a small community of only 2,000 members on reservation here, and we have an 8,000 membership across the world. But it was in the 2016 flood that our eyes were really more than opened. They were widened to the possibilities of what could happen if the water and the flood and all the weathering conditions had formulated into a larger catastrophe than what the 2016 flood was. More so because of the exposures.
By the exposure, meaning?
Well, it's really reflected well in the film, so we hope that you get out to see it, and they have a really great history of that there. But the exposures of the pipe is exposed in some areas on the river. So as Mary had referred to before, that the river is shifting and moving more towards the pipeline herself. It's creating a meander.
Talk about the threat of not just the pipeline, but of course of a rupture or break in the pipeline and a flooding out of tar sand soil. What that means for Bad River Band's way of life.
We're a woodland people, and traditionally we're harvesters, and so we harvest wild rice up here in this region. We have the most beautiful and prominent sloughs. We have many awards and accolades for our sloughs and our caretaking of them. And the sloughs is where the wild rice grows. And in order to understand that importance of that wild rice, you have to understand our history. And I think that's why in the film, Mary and her team had to put together a really great story of the history in order to get to where we are today and why it's so important. The Monoman or as we call it, the wild rice up here in this region, in the northern region of Michigan, Minnesota, and Wisconsin here. That's part of our migration story. When we came here millennia ago, it was told that we were to go where the food grows on water, and that related to the wild rice. So we came here, we made agreements that we would take care of the rice here, and the rice would take care of us. So when we think about threats, it's not just that we would be losing a commodity, we would be losing a way of life, because that way of life has sustained us for thousands of years in this area.
I muted myself and forgot to put myself back on. You're listening to Aurora Conley of the Bad River Band of Chippewa North. And we're talking about the ongoing struggle up there by Lake Superior between the Bad River Band and others and the Enbridge Corporation and the pipeline Line 5. Give us a call at 608-256-2001 if you'd like to join with a question, a comment, an observation for our guest today, Aurora Conley, who's with us for the rest of the hour. Again, give us a call at 608-256-2001. A threat to a way of life. Certainly, that brings to the forefront the issue of indigenous sovereignty. That's been denied for so long, but it's a struggle just to maintain it, it seems, from day to day. Talk about that.
As I had referred to before, it was originally the Bureau of Indian Affairs that had granted this right of way across our land. So that right there was an exercise of not tribal sovereignty. And we have the right to make decisions for our own people in our own lands, and to say yes and to say no, and to give reason for that. And sometimes to even not give reason for that, just the fact that we said no. I remember in a meeting about 7-8 years ago, before we launched the suit and before all the legal stuff came in, I was sitting in a meeting and one of the attorneys kept asking, if we say no to the pipeline and do not grant their easements. And he kept saying, if we say no. And at that point, the resolution from the tribe had already passed, stating that we weren't going to renew their easement or their right of way. And I remember telling him, because at that time, the issue of Standing Rock and the DAPL pipeline over in the Dakotas was happening. And he kept saying, I don't know if we can handle a Standing Rock issue here. I don't know if we can have that kind of capacity. If we say no, if we say no. And I remember telling him, we already said no. That's not something that I find in the strength of Bad River and our history, as you're going to see in the film. When we say no, that's exactly what we meant. We meant that in a tribal sovereignty kind of exercise. So for them to keep kind of alluding to the fact that we were going to come back and say, okay, and then we'll take the money. Or as you said before, they keep offering us dollar amounts for this easement. But in an exercise of our tribal sovereignty, we just said that, no, we do not want the pipeline through a reservation. It should be so simple.
You've done a fair amount of, and so much of this overlaps, a fair amount of environmental work. Talk about the environmental concerns, the very real threat of an imminent tar sand spill disaster, and what it would mean to the entire region, the Upper Great Lakes.
Right. So we live on Lake Superior, on the shores of Lake Superior. The pipeline runs from west to east, about 13 miles through our reservation. The length in total of the whole pipeline is 1,098 total miles, and that's from Superior, Wisconsin to Sarnia, Ontario, in Canada. Now, we've seen some of their issues, per se, like, for instance, with Kalamazoo in 2010 when their Enbridge pipeline rushed through there and spilled 1 million gallons into their river. And that was in 2010. That was 14 years ago. One of our elders said that she just came back from that community, and they are still purchasing bottled water. When you think about that in the context of the larger Lake Superior, which is, you know, 20% of the world's fresh water, and how close that pipeline is to it, and when you consider what the potential could be for 1 million gallons spilling into the river, and that's not just for us, that's for the community, what would that do to the lake? What would that do to the ecosystem? And I mean, we already know what would happen to our wild rice. It would die off and kill the rice. So I think that's our main cultural concern. But as far as our biggest environmental concern, it is the lake and that ecosystem there that we've maintained for thousands of years.
You just mentioned the pipeline's close proximity to Lake Superior. Talk about that a little bit. The eroding bank on the river and how close it is to the pipeline.
Oh yeah, it's within a mile of the pipeline, the eroding bank, and that seems to be an issue right now that they're debating in litigation. We're calling it the meander issue because the lake, you want to talk about tribal sovereignty, we should talk about environmental sovereignty, and that the earth is going to do what she wants to do. And right now she's trying to meander and cut around that the pipeline that's out there. As far as it being so close to the lake, I think that's one of my biggest fears personally. It just being so close to the lake. When we had the 2016 flood, I remember there was a NASA satellite that had caught images of the dirt plumes, all the erosion and everything that had flooded out and washed out into the bay. And you could see it from space, this big brown chunk that was coming out of the sloughs and coming out of the Bad River area here from that flood. And it was just realistic for me, wondering what would happen if there is another 50-year flood, another 100-year flood. What happens if there is exposures? What happens if it does break? These are all things that a lot of Enbridge engineers have tried to reassure that they have planned for. But considering that they had a break in Kalamazoo and other places along their pipelines, it doesn't feel as much reassuring.
608-256-2001. If you would like to join our program and speak with our guest Aurora Conley today, again, 608-256-2001. Give us a call with your question, a comment, and observation. Talk about there's this proposal that Enbridge put forward to do a bypass around.
Yes, the reroute.
The reroute, yeah. Talk about that a little bit.
From my understanding, once they realized that we were trying to exercise our tribal sovereignties and that we basically said that we wouldn't be renewing their easement, they devised a plan to go around the reservation, which would target the southern area. So going through like the Mellon area, Glidden areas, somewhat closer to the Pinoki Mountains, which ironically is something that we had to fight for 11 years ago when we were doing the mining issues and they were trying to do mountaintop mining up there in the Pinoki Mountains. So that's also a very big concern for us.
608-256-2001. So that part of it, the rerouting still goes through the watershed. It still affects the broader regional environment.
Yes. It's still located in the watershed. It would just be adding on 13 miles to the south of us. It would be, so the pipeline would then come from Superior down towards Ashland area and then cut south all around the reservation and then cut back up instead of their straight shot through like they have now.
You know, I can hear, you know, as we're talking about this stuff, as I was preparing, I could hear the voices saying, what's the big deal? Why the alarm? What's the urgency? You touched on it, but I want to go a little bit deeper into some of Enbridge's history as a genuine cause of alarm. You mentioned that the 2010 Enbridge pipeline rupture that spilled nearly, 1 million gallons of oil into the Kalamazoo River in Michigan. What effect did that have? And, you know, the fact, of course, that if the pipelines we're talking about here, excuse me, here in Wisconsin, are carrying even larger volumes of tar sands toxic oil.
I think the scarier part of that is not knowing what it would look like, because ultimately we don't know. I don't think Kalamazoo was prepared for that type of spill. I don't think any community would definitely be prepared for that type of skill, no matter how many tabletop exercises you do or engineering or how many experts you have come into a room and say, these are the possibilities. No one really knows. And I think just having that kind of track record of not knowing and not being able to mitigate or remedy the situations, like I had mentioned, it's been 14 years. And one of our elders was just over in that community. I have never been yet, but I would still like to connect with folks from Kalamazoo and support them. And also, ask for their support as well as we engage in this battle because of some of the issues that they've had. We would like to know, you know, what were some of the catastrophes there? What are some of the things that they're dealing with? And we have, but I would like to know on a more grassroots level so that we can make those connections, because it really, really, really is so important, and especially to our fight here in Bad River. But we know what's at stake in terms of our livelihood, in terms of our water, but definitely not knowing exactly what could happen if there was to be a spill of any kind of amount specifically. And we also, sorry, and just to also note that when we did ask, we had a community meeting a few weeks ago, and one of our councilwomen stood up and said that when they did ask Enbridge about what would be a spill look like, the closest place, it would take them 3 hours to get here to Bad River in the event of a spill. Now, when you calculate things out, by the time they even got here, all the oil would have already hit Lake Superior.
Talk about the growing movement. That is, of course, there's a mobilization going on within the Bad River Band and allies. But talk about the broader, appears, you know, just going on online and looking at material, that there's a lot of solidarity. There's, I know that people have gone from Madison. Friends of mine have gone up north to join. And, you know, certainly last June there was a big mobilization. But talk about that movement building.
Wow. So it's been, it's honestly, it's been a little hard, Alan. Enbridge, uh-huh. You know, comes into the community, and there is a divisiveness here at some point. Some of our community members do want the money. You know, you have to remember, we're a small, small community of only 2,000 people here in house. And we're dealing with a number of already big challenges with the opioid epidemic, with housing issues, poverty. These are all issues that as a community, as a tribal council, that we have to deal with on a daily, day-to-day basis. And then you throw in the threat of a pipeline that already has issues and already has a company history of just a bad track, kind of. So when you think about our small community and all the issues that we have to deal with, we do need that solidarity. We do need that support. And we're so grateful to be able to build that in spaces within our community, for one, even though it's a hotly contemplated issue here in our community. And garnering that support from our neighbors, from the locals, from people across the state, from the region, and across the country too, as we go into this big litigation that's now sitting in a big circuit court down in Chicago, 7th District, if I'm not mistaken. And just helping build that capacity to be able to just feel supported. Honestly, as an activist and a mother here in this community, it is pretty daunting. It is a daunting task to help and do as much as you can in the community. So when people are supportive and they're helpful and they connect people and we get to do radio interviews with great folks and tell our story a little bit, it really does help garner that support.
Well, there's a nice plug for WORT. Give us a call at 608-256-2001 if you want to join in this conversation. Excuse me. Jade, our producer, tells me that we have a couple people waiting. Let's open the lines. Hey, Mark, you're on the air.
Hey, Alan. Hi, Aurora. I just want to first start by thanking Aurora for history of engaging in this struggle. And I know that it's not easy, but the leadership that she and the Bad River Tribe and Indigenous people have given in environmental struggles is is really critical and just very inspiring. Thank you, Aurora. Couple quick comments that there are like three reasons for simply saying no to this line. And one is indigenous sovereignty, and the other is the extreme environmental danger that it poses and the existential threat of climate change. We have to move away from this kind of fossil fuel infrastructure. And I guess my last comment is just going to be understanding a little bit more about who Enbridge is. I mean, this is an extremely, they have an extreme violent, arrogant history. Aurora mentioned Standing Rock. They were one of the investors there with the kind of violence, paramilitary violence that was visited upon demonstrators. They militarized northern Minnesota to millions of dollars, arrested over 1,000 people who resisted their building line or rebuilding line three. And it's really important to look at the environmental damage that we're just now understanding that took place. It is going on in northern Minnesota, piercing of at least four major aquifers, multiple frack outs, meaning all these like unidentified chemicals spilling into waterways and aquifers when horizontal drilling is taking place under rivers. Like that damage alone should be alarming. And, you know, they're just part of a broader sort of extraction industry that is extremely dangerous. And I'll just come back to what Mary, the film person, was talking about, is how many times the people in the North, indigenous people and others who live there, have had to struggle to fight the Jacobic taconite mine, to fight Project ELF, to defend against the burying of nuclear waste. And again, I just want to express a deep heartfelt thanks for the sort of, inspiring struggle that gives us hope and has meant a great deal to the people of the Great Lakes and Wisconsin region. So thank you, Aurora.
That was a friend of WORT's, an old friend of mine, and a fellow traveler, Mark Rosenthal, who has been in this struggle around environment and indigenous rights for decades. So thank you, Mark Rosenthal. A comment back to Mark, Aurora?
I just want to thank you again. And like we were talking about how we garner the support, those kinds of supports are just amazing. Sometimes it's just somebody to, you know, shake your hand and tell you, yes, you're doing a good job. Yes, you're doing the right thing. It could be that small and simple. There's all types of ways you can support the tribe, depending on how you're able. And this goes back to many things, but go see the film. Definitely go see the film. Half of the proceeds come back to the tribe for our defense fund. You'll be able to see more of the film, of our history that, like Mark referred to, in terms of like the mining issues that we went through a decade ago. Now we're fighting the pipeline this decade, and we'll continue to fight that battle. And I'm really, really just proud of the film and the way that Mary and everyone pulled it together.
Let's go back to the phones. Hello, John, you're on the air.
Hi. It's a pleasure to meet you, Aurora. Thanks for talking on the radio and explaining some of this stuff. I've worked with and for Bad River for many years on the mining issues and now on the pipeline issue. And I work on technical stuff. But one thing that I've really picked up on, I think, is that Enbridge seems to have an unlimited supply of money to throw at communities and individuals to get their way. And I'm wondering if you want to talk about that anymore. It just seems like an overwhelming amount of money that Enbridge throws at this issue.
A kind of a divide and conquer with greenbacks.
Oh, yes. Yeah, that is their strategy.
I mean, we saw that with the town of Mellon.
They definitely...
A buyout. Sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah. Precisely. they tend to like to create divisiveness in the community, and they're well aware that we're a poor community. I mean, I'm not ashamed of that by any means. We are a small, poor community. We're a reservation that's had to fight and battle and really conquer some really tough, hard things for a couple centuries now, as far as colonialism goes. They do have they have an unlimited amount of money, but somehow it just never seems to be enough. So that's always my answer, because I don't put, you know, we do sell rice here $20 a pound for a means at some point. And why do we do that? Well, because it's the harvesting of it is so traditional and so special, and just the rice itself is so beautiful. It's hard to put a price on it, right? You could say $20 a pound, and we have so many X amount of pounds in the sloughs, and you could break it down into a science and something that Enbridge could understand. But what they don't understand is the importance of that rice to us, and that it is not worth any amounts of millions of dollars. That's it, that it perpetuates into the future. So, you know, Mary mentioned that they gave us a counter offer last week of $80 million. That sounds amazing. What could we do with $80 million? I don't think it would be life changing for individual members, but would it change this community? That's another unknown. I mean, we have a plethora of issues here, and I think they're also very aware of that. Like I had mentioned before, you know, with the opioid epidemic and housing issues like the rest of the nation is facing, and trying to come up and take care of our own people has been really a struggle in terms of monetary. But like I said, yes, they have lots of money, but for me, it'll never be enough.
You know, as is so often the case, we get callers toward the end of the hour, and it's getting short now, so I want to try to get everybody in. Okay. Steve, hi, you're on the air.
Yeah, Ms. Connolly, forgive me if this question is outside of your purview, but the civil engineer in me is curious as to the pipe as a thing, its dimensions, the composition of the barrier wall, the hydraulic pressure, and how that's maintained. I know this is nerd stuff, but that's who I am. But maybe you can direct me to some sources. Thanks, Alan.
Definitely. I do have some facts. I know, like, the diameter of the pipe is 30 inches. The pipe wall thickness is about 0.28 to about 0.38. It's steel grade. The exterior pipe coating is a coal tar enamel. The weld type is a submerged arc weld, and it's buried 6 feet underground, although waterways may vary. It carries a sweet light crude oil and an NGLLP gas. It carries 540,000 barrels per day.
So there you have it. There you have it, Steve. Aurora comes well armed to the conversation.
A little bit, I try to be. I know that some folks are very curious about it, and what, you know, so as was I. I wanted to know more about this stuff too. I mean, I'm no engineer by any means, but on some layman's term, I have a basic understanding. And that's something that I wanted to say too, that we're not engineers, and we don't have that kind of capacity. You know, we have to outsource some of our experts to come in and help us with this stuff. But we are experts in our own land.
Great. And we do have one more caller waiting. Sierra, hi. You're on the air.
Yes, hi. Very much in admiration of what you and your tribe and your allies are doing. Just have a quick comment and a question. Some of this certainly reminds me of this movie that's called Killers of the Flower Moon. Some of it is just so, you know how similar it is. And there's some really good documentaries out now online, as well as, of course, the book. And my question is, we were working with a lot of the state representatives, senators, and the governor and their administration during the mining. And there were specific people that were really helpful and some that were not, and some neutral. And I was wondering if you had any information on the current crop of state people in government and how they're doing on this issue. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Sierra. Thank you so much. Yeah. Mary had spoke earlier about the kind of relationship with Killers of the Flower Moon and how the film that we have coming out, the Bad River film that is coming out tomorrow, documentary about this issue, how it kind of parallels in different eras. And that, you know, Indigenous people are still fighting for their lands. We're still fighting for our sovereignties, even though the Killers of the Flower Moon was based, you know, 100 years ago. We're still feeling the effects of some of these atrocities that are happening against our lands. And as far as the government, what they're doing, I don't have a big take on that now. It seems like a lot of them, a lot of our state representatives haven't taken a strong hold on it yet. But we're hoping with the documentary and to garner some of the more of that support and getting a word out there that we could definitely get some of our representatives to hold on strong and stay strong with us.
Well, we now have one more caller, so let's get them in. We have yet a few minutes left in the hour. David, hi, you're on the air.
Yeah, morning. I'm thinking about the DAPL pipeline as opposed to Line 5. I remember that one was 1,200 miles long, but the permit process for all 1,200 miles, and it crossed 200 different waterways, they got the permits all done within 6 months. Now, that seems pretty impossible. And so then what made it even wilder was some of the land that they crossed in places like Iowa, Nebraska, whatnot. That's multi-million-dollar acre land. It's fantastic topsoil. And when you have a spill in somebody's multi-million-dollar an acre land, that can be extremely costly. So how is it that they were able to permit something like that in 6 months' time? Is there just enormous corruption in this? Or, you know, how did this permit process happen?
As far as the initial permit process, we're not exactly sure how that happened either. We're still garnering a lot of documents. Well, they did garner a lot of documents and try to figure exactly how that went through, but you would be absolutely right. I don't think that the BIA or the Bureau of Indian Affairs really had the tribes at that time, maybe environmental concerns. You have to remember that this pipeline was built in 1953, so it even predates the Clean Water Act. It predates a lot of the acts that have been put into the tribe. A lot of acts that have been put in through the country in terms of environmental writing. So I think it's just the date and how there wasn't a lot of permits that needed to go through as extensively as it might have to now.
You know, I was remembering as I was preparing for the program, the fact that this pipeline, the Enbridge Line 5, comes into Wisconsin from Canada at Superior, goes across the northern part of the state, goes into Michigan, and then goes back basically to Canada.
Yes.
So who is it benefiting here?
It's not benefiting us. We know that as a fact.
You know, the it's quite incredible, and they have part of it. They want to go under the Mackinac Straits, and there's already a line. They want to put a second line through underneath on the bottom of the lake. It's phenomenal stuff, and sometimes you can't make it up. It's stranger than fiction. So
I'm glad that you said phenomenal, because it is. But what?
Did you freeze? I think we lost Aurora. Oh yeah, we lost our guest here today. Well, you've been listening to Aurora Conley, who's with the Bad River Band of Chippewa, up way up north by Lake Superior. We've been talking about a range of issues having to do with the Line 5 Enbridge pipeline in the battle to have it. Oh, we lost Aurora entirely. Oh, are you back now?
Yes.
You froze for a minute there.
Yeah, sorry about that.
You know, that's it happens. Some final words for our audience. How might people get involved if they wish, or, you know?
Definitely go watch the film in Madison this weekend. Check the website, www.badriverfilm.com, for showing times and get your tickets. Definitely go check out the film. Half the proceeds come back to our defense fund. And if you aren't able to and you just rather just donate, you can check out www.defendthebadriver.org.
Well, Aurora, I want to thank you ever so much. I hope to have you back at some point, because this struggle isn't going away tomorrow.
No.
Lots of you folks in it for the long haul, as are many people in the Madison area. I want to thank Jade for producing. I want to thank Jack for engineering. I want to thank you, our number of callers that called in today. I want to thank you all for listening. I've been your host for this hour. My name is Alan Ruff, and I'll be speaking with you next week.
Don't take no prisoners if you can't afford to feed none. Don't start no fights if you cannot predict the outcome. Don't make donations where you cannot get your dough back. The apathetic bulls, the cinema, your Prozac. I will not climb into your telephone tree, and hell no, you cannot put me on hold. It's the same recorded message you've been singing all along. Keep handing us the Bible while you're walking off with all the gold. The bureaucratic office sends you merry-go-rounding, while the KKK police the streets by bloodhounding. Interest on the credit card just keeps on compounding, but the FCC can never shut this pirate sound down. Live and direct, we come and never pre-recorded, with information that will never be reported. Disregard the mainstream.
You're listening to WORP's 89.9 FM, Madison.
Information that would never be reported. Disregard the mainstream. Media distorted. We come and listen and support it. Live and direct, we come and never pre-recorded. With an admission that would never be reported. Disregard the mainstream. Media distorted. We come and listen and support it. Live and direct, we come and never pre-recorded. With information that would never be reported. Disregard the mainstream, media distorted. We come and listen and support it.
Une fois que t'as senti l'âme, tu t'allonges sur ton dos.
Yeah.
Tu es le temps. Tu te marques des bureaux. Tu t'enfonces dans ta
main.
This is Pacifica Radio's Letters on Politics. On today's show...
So in my book, I say Palestinian Samoan. What does it mean? Is it only cultural resistance? Is it peaceful resistance? Well, it means to continue to live in your way, to practice your culture, you know, not to back down. But at the same time, it also means armed resistance.
a conversation on Palestinian culture during a time of occupation, exile, and plausible genocide. Our guest is Tahrir Hamdi, professor of decolonial studies and president of Arab Open University in Jordan. She is the author of the book Imagining Palestine, Cultures of Exile and National Identity. That's next on Letters and Politics. But first, the news.
BBC News with Sue Montgomery. The US Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer has said Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu no longer meets the needs of his country and Israelis should hold an election. He said if the Israeli leader continued to pursue what he called dangerous and inflammatory policies, the US should use its leverage to persuade him to change course. Tom Bateman reports from Washington.
Mr. Schumer leads the Democrats in the US Senate, and describing himself as the highest-ranking Jewish elected official ever in America, made a speech that excoriated Mr. Netanyahu's leadership of Israel, calling in effect for his replacement, lest the country should become what he described as a pariah state. He made clear that Hamas bore the responsibility for unleashing the current war, but said he was anguished that the Israeli war campaign had killed so many innocent Palestinians. This amounts to the most significant intervention yet from a senior US politician.
Gaza's Hamas-run health ministry says six Palestinians have been killed by Israeli forces while waiting for aid trucks in Gaza City. Israel has yet to comment. 2 weeks ago, the ministry blamed Israeli soldiers for the death of more than 100 Palestinians who'd crowded around an aid convoy. The Starship rocket developed by Elon Musk's firm